give Lebanon a chance to recover and to stop the collapse that is happening, the free fall that is happening, actually. And this is why we're giving it a chance, actually, based on also a program that we discussed with the Prime Minister and that included a lot of the requirements and the requests we have put in it.
Miqati's 24-member cabinet is also expected to offer solutions to shortages of medicine and fuel and to launch a social welfare card as a compensation for the local currency's lost value.
The government is expected to address all of these problems together, but they have to prioritize the problems. The Lebanese now, the mere Lebanese, the lay Lebanese, and the majority of the Lebanese are not capable of meeting their basic needs in order to survive. So we pin the hopes on the government to be able to prioritize the needs of the people and to address the most important. When we talk about the most important, we talk about the financial crisis, we talk about correcting the level of the wages for the Lebanese, and even to give a compensation so they can meet their basic needs.
The Miqati cabinet has vowed to prepare for parliamentary elections and hold them on time in May of 2022.
The Miqati cabinet has stressed in its manifesto that now is the time for action and not words. The lawmakers, for their part, have considered that this government and all future cabinets must work on rebuilding the economy instead of relying on grants and loans. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Far away from their homes, the battle for survival continues for thousands of Rohingya refugees living across India. After fleeing war-ravaged Myanmar and what the UN described as ethnic cleansing, they are now trying to rebuild their shattered lives in different parts of the world. But in India, they are sometimes called illegal immigrants and threat to national security, which activists describe as a deliberate attempt to target a particular community. Apparently, they are also accused of illegal activities. But these claims were not reflected in the recently released National Crime Records Bureau analysis.
There is no evidence whatsoever about Rohingyas being involved in anything even close to terrorist activity. This is the paranoia of the Indian deep state, which increasingly wants to do all this fear-mongering to increase its budget.
Based on analysis of the Government Crime Records Agency for 2020, Myanmar nationals accounted for just 2% of the total crimes allegedly committed by foreigners. Analysts say there is no case of terror, rape, or keeping arms against any Rohingya refugee, which belies the government claim of calling them a security threat.
We just want to stay alive. We are no threat to anyone since we are humans and have family too. We are really in a miserable state as a detention and expulsion campaign is going on.
Based on official estimates, some 40,000 Rohingya refugees are living in parts of India. Many refugees I spoke with had almost similar views. They say they felt safe in India since they arrived, but over the last few years, hate campaigns against the community are haunting them. As refugee crises continue to be the biggest challenge facing the world, rights activists say Rohingya community in particular has largely been ignored despite the levels of atrocities it has endured, both at home and as refugees. They say India needs to rethink and redraw its refugee policy regardless of the geostrategic interest and stand by its ethos considering the world as a family. Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled to neighboring Bangladesh and other countries, including India, escaping genocide in their country. Regardless of the refugee crisis across the world, the community continues to be neglected and unseen victims of violence. Munawar Zaman in the outskirts of New Delhi.
Protesters set up a cage outside Denmark's embassy in Iran, a cage with a cake inside to celebrate the fifth birthday of Dariush. This is the second year in a row that Dariush's mother, Mahsa, celebrates her son's birthday without him, as Dariush has been taken away from his family by the Copenhagen municipality for parental incompetence reasons. Something which the distraught mom dismisses as unfair. She says she misses her son.
My son suffers from autism, but the Danish authorities blame me for all of my son's disorders, like inability to sleep or eat. I was even referred to a pediatrician who approved that my son is an autistic. But the authorities in Denmark refused to accept the reality and accused me of misbehavior toward my child. I urged the Iranian government and the foreign ministry to take measures so I can see my son again.
Mahsa has lived in Denmark for 6 years, but does not have the Danish permanent residency. She says she and her husband have both agreed to return to Iran, but Copenhagen refuses to grant them their son's custody. Rights activists here demand that the Danish government help Mahsa reunite with her son.
In every country, the law says that if a family is unfit to keeping the custody of their children, the government must remove the children from that family. But regarding Mahsa's case, the Danish government needs to hand the affected child to the relative Iranian entities to take care of the issue. Because Mahsa does not have a permanent Danish residency, and the case should be delegated to her country of origin.
While it was not possible for journalists and Mahsa to reach the Danish embassy to investigate the matter, Mahsa says she continues to publicize her cause and try any available legal channel to take her son back.
Apparently, it takes a lengthy and complicated legal procedure for Mahsa to get to her son. But what's clear is that 5-year-old Dariush is now living far from his mom, and nothing can replace the peaceful bosom of a mother for a child. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Thirteen days after breaking out from Gilboa Jail, Israel's maximum security prison, Ayham Kamamji and Munadal Enfi'at were rearrested by Israeli forces during a military incursion into northern city of Jenin in the occupied West Bank. Kamamji and Enfi'at, both members of the Islamic Jihad movement, were the last of six Palestinian prisoners who escaped Gilboa prison on September 6. Like their fellow inmates, they were immediately taken to an unknown place for interrogation, and the Israeli authorities have extended their detention to continue the interrogation process. Palestinian Authorities Commission of Detainees Affairs held Israel responsible for their lives and said it's illegal to retry prisoners who are already serving sentences and life sentences.
Israelis are trying to cover up the scandal of the prison break. The prisoners who succeeded to flee were serving life sentences. Now, Israel's decision to extend their detention under interrogation serves only to soothe the public outrage on Israeli streets. We warn Israeli authorities against harming the prisoners, especially if they continue placing them in solitary confinement for lengthy periods after their interrogation.
The inmates were arrested after a large number of Israeli troops raided different parts of Jenin. Clashes broke out between Palestinians and Israeli soldiers in a number of locations, with stones and explosives thrown towards Israeli forces. A number of Palestinians were moderately wounded during the clashes, according to medics. Moreover, two Palestinians were arrested during the operation. The Israeli military claims they had helped Kamamji and Enfi'at hide in Jenin.
Israel boasted of a security image, but it was tarnished by the Palestinian inmates' prison break. Now, even the rearrest of the last two inmates in Jenin cannot boost the image. The prison break was a great blow for Israel.
Last weekend, Zakaria Zubaydi, Mahmoud Arda, Mohammed Qadiri, and Mohammed Arda were captured by Israeli forces in and near Nazareth, northern the occupied lands. Their lawyers said the men have been subjected to physical and mental abuse and torture by Israeli interrogators, and each of them is placed in 2-by-1-square-meter room lacking basic necessities for life.
Palestinians say Israel's security failure can never be rectified by the rearrest of the six prisoners or through the Israeli military operations across the occupied territories. They add the fact at the end of the day proves that the jailbreak has embarrassed Israel's security establishment. Mona Khandil, Occupy Ramallah.
The rearrest of the last two remaining Palestinian inmates who had escaped from an Israeli jail has sparked public outrage among the Palestinians. Palestinians have come together in the Gaza Strip to voice their anger at Israel's growing pressure on the Palestinian inmates.
We in the Gaza Strip stress that fight against the Israeli occupation will go on and the rearrest of the inmates won't deter us from expressing our solidarity with them. The prison break of the Palestinian inmates has inflicted a heavy blow on Israel's image. The resistance front has vowed to set them free in the coming exchange deal. We will never forget this achievement.
Reports say the two men were caught alive in Jenin, their hometown in the West Bank, after they were surrounded by Israeli army.
We have come here to condemn the inhumane Israeli treatment of our prisoners. Our message to our inmates is that we will keep supporting them until they are freed. The international community has ignored the issue of Palestinian prisoners for years.
2 weeks ago, six Palestinian inmates caved through a dug hole in the floor of their shared cell, exposing deep security flaws of Israeli system. Palestinians held several rallies calling for ending the Israeli violation of prisoners' rights.
Palestinians will keep holding events like this to voice their support to our detainees in Israeli jails. Israeli regime should know that our prisoners are not alone and we view them as symbol of resistance. The international community should break its silence and expose the true nature of Israeli regime.
Thousands of Palestinians are held in Israeli jails, with hundreds of them under the practice of administrative detention.
Palestinians here stress the rearresting of two inmates who broke out of the Jilbo prison does not hide the fragility of the Israeli security system. Palestinians see this cave as a remarkable incident in the history of the Palestinian cause, demanding the international community to stop Israel's torture against detainees. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
The serial killings of Iranian scientists must stop. This comment was made by families of the five slain nuclear scientists who were allegedly assassinated by Israeli agents. Now, the households of the victims have filed a lawsuit against the U.S. for its support for Tel Aviv and what people here call terrorist activities against Iran.
I believe the reason that they did this in front of my eyes and my mother's eyes was to terrorize people. That's what terrorists do.
We have already gotten too late into this legal proceeding. They killed my husband 12 years ago, and I still feel the pain. It's not easy to forget such a great loss. The point is, America and Israel do not feel sorry for this, and that's why we ask Iranian and international judicial systems to bring the perpetrators to justice.
Iran does not recognize Israel as a country. This is why the case is not directly aimed at Israel, but is targeting the U.S. as a supporting force behind Tel Aviv. If succeeded, the move will lead to the freezing of American assets in foreign countries.
We are now waiting for the verdict of Iran's court for international affairs. We will follow up the case in countries that maintain judicial cooperation with Iran. There, we will demand that U.S. assets be blocked and transferred as compensation to the families of the victims. This is to remind the criminal governments that their crimes will not go unanswered.
Israel has a history of targeted killing of Iranian nuclear scientists since 2010. While Tel Aviv has not commented on any of the assassinations, its footsteps can be traced in all of the incidents. In this video, recorded in 2018, ex-Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu gives the game away.
Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, head of Project Abad, put it. Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
Less than 2 years after this comment, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who was a key Iranian nuclear scientist, was assassinated. Over the years, different American and Israeli officials have spoken openly about, quote, taking down the nuts and bolts of Iran's nuclear industry. The plaintiffs here say the U.S. once tried to do so by killing Iranian nuclear scientists, and today by enforcing the so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran. But they say both measures have so far failed, and the West is now urging Iran to sit and talk about its nuclear program in Vienna to revive the 2015 nuclear pact.
Plaintiffs here hope that their lawsuit against the U.S. will break the chain of Washington's targeting of the Iranian scientific community. But they say the underlying messages are even more important, as the case lays bare the U.S.'s double standards with regards to human rights. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
many cities in France, anti-health pass protesters marched again in what has become a weekly protest. They do not agree with the mandatory measures the French government has established to obtain much more vaccinations. But the protest movement is weakening a bit. Important figures of the Yellow Vests want to re-engage with the original inquiries of the movement, more social justice and against the authoritarian policy of the government. They want to elaborate a political force that will be able to influence the 2022 presidential elections.
Today we are with the angry citizens against the health pass, but as the Yellow Vest movement, we continue demanding more social justice and less taxes and a participative democracy.
70% of the French have received two jabs of the anti-COVID vaccine. Due to the health pass that people have to show in almost every public places, the virus is soon to be under control and life in France is slowly returning back to normal. The National Institute on Economic Studies, INSEE, announced that the French gross domestic product, GDP, will increase with more than 6% in 2021, after a fall last year of 10%. This is good news for the economy, except that workers' rights are deeply affected by the COVID crisis. More and more people lose their full-time contract, which is often transformed in variable working hours and a temporary contract, less paid and most of all, offering less job security.
I am a volunteer worker. I see the misery. We distribute food. There is much more misery now and more young people are in need.
During the lockdown, people with precarious contracts were affected the most. Today, the government of Macron is reforming the unemployment status. He makes the labor market very flexible. He takes advantage of this crisis to implement his antisocial policy.
French President Macron had once declared that an unemployed person just has to cross the street to find a job. For many people, this is only wishful thinking. The vaccination campaign is certainly successful in pushing back the COVID virus and putting the economy back on track. But the French population remains deeply divided about the mandatory health pass. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of Halim, please.
Hi,
Kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
The Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of instrument.
The Spotlight.
Some 12,000 migrants, mostly from Haiti, have been staying at a camp under a bridge in Del Rio, Texas. Department of Homeland Security saying that 6,500 migrants were taken to custody in advance of processing and removal from the U.S., and on Sunday, flights started to carry Haitian asylum seekers back home. The United Nations has voiced concerns at the U.S. deportation of mostly Haitian refugees. American rights groups have also demanded a halt to the deportations. Expulsions are taking place under a health order, citing the coronavirus pandemic. Now, to begin with this, let's go to Washington, D.C. Our correspondent, Colin Campbell's there. Colin, tell us more about this migration thing and the problems.
Yes, the crisis at the border is very troubling because of the policies that the U.S. has enacted on Haitian immigrants who have walked through Brazil, through South America, to get to the border. Can you imagine walking through Brazil and then walking to the border, just some of the atrocities that you face along the way? Well, thousands of Haitian immigrants have gone through this journey in hopes of a better life in America. And this is the welcome that they received. Border Patrol agents on horseback using whips to control them. Children starving, people starving, children crying, getting out of the way of these Border Patrol agents. The imagery is very shocking as we see these people who are already in a very destitute state being welcomed by America, so to speak, in a way that would make them seem like enemies of the country, make them seem like they are invaders to the country. And right now, the Biden administration is being harangued by many who are saying, listen, you need to retool U.S. immigration policy right now because the way you're treating these Haitians is ineffable. And right now, the Biden administration has been deporting thousands of immigrants back to Haiti. When they return, they're worse or no better off than they were when reaching the United States.
This is The Spotlight. You're watching Spotlight with me, your host, Behruz Najib. And as you see, we're discussing the migrant problem in the United States. Let me see who's joining me in this episode of The Spotlight. Okay, we have a professor with the City University of New York, Danny Shaw, who's joining us from New York. And later I'll be joined by author and political analyst for the Center for Political Innovation, Keaton Mansfield, also in New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Now, Danny, as you know, U.S. authorities are taking advantage of this pandemic-related health rule called Title 42 health rule, and that was made under former President Donald Trump to expel many of the migrants without offering them, you know, the chance to seek asylum. Is this what Joe Biden had promised to do while he was running in the race for the White House?
Well, I think even beyond the bipartisan issues, whether Biden increases the number of Haitian immigrants and migrants in general who are allowed to come here or doesn't, we have to get in front of this narrative and underneath this narrative that people are just coming here because the United States is so great. What exists here is the relationship between a neo-colonizer and a neo-colony. Many of these Haitians were forced out of Haiti after the 2010 earthquake. They were living in Chile. They were living in Brazil. That situation was no longer tenable. So they continued to travel north, trying to make it to the U.S. and to be met here with insults, racism, humiliation, and even whips from the Border Patrol. The symbolism is huge in terms of how the U.S. ruling class and the U.S. population sees Haiti and Haiti's people. So I think this is an important educational moment so people understand the true relationship that exists between the most powerful imperialist country in the history of humanity and Haiti, which continues to be a neo-colony in the Caribbean.
Mm-hmm. Danny, maybe you've seen those pictures of U.S. border guards using, you know, horse reins to control immigrants. Some observers say that those pictures remind them of the violence seen during the slavery times in the U.S. How do you feel when you see such scenes? Is this how the land of opportunity deals with asylum seekers?
Yeah, the land of opportunity in big quotation marks. That's part of this mythology that capitalism and white supremacy tries to spread around the world. Those images of the whips and the patronizing tone of the racist, white supremacist tone of those Border Patrol guards also harkens back to the 1915 and 1934 U.S. military occupation of Haiti when thousands of Marines stepped on Haitian dignity and Haitian sovereignty and track down the CACOs, the Haitian resistance fighters. The same thing that's happened today in the neocon, whether it was under the auspices of the now assassinated Jovenel Moïse, or under Ariel Henry, the prime minister today, the PHTK, the party in power, continues to repress the Haitian popular movement. So Haitians are asking across the country and across the diaspora, when will we be afforded a chance to survive in our own homeland?
Okay. Now, author and public analyst for the Center for Public Innovation, Keithan Mansfield, is also joining us from New York. Good to have with us, Keithan. So the question I have for you is, there are some people who are blaming the policies of President Biden's for this influx of migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border. What factors play a role here?
Well, with the advanced people, I believe you have to look back what happened. It's very telling.
Sorry, I got to jump in. Keithan, we don't hear you, right? So let me just go back to Danny and give our technicians a little bit of time to see if they can fix this problem. Daniel, let our viewers hear your opinion on how President Trump's policies could be responsible for this influx of migrants.
And I would go way before President Trump or President Bush or Tweedledee or Tweedledum, two sides of the same coin. This is decades and centuries of unfettered colonialism and neocolonialism practiced on what many have called the U.S.'s backyard, the Caribbean, Central America, the entire hemisphere. The Haitian people want a new way forward. The Haitian leadership has communicated from Port-au-Prince and Cap-Haïtien their enthusiasm in seeing the message of Evo Morales going to Cuba and then to Venezuela and CELAC and Nicolas Maduro regrouping in Mexico City. The pivot of López Obrador and the Mexican leadership denouncing the blockade of Cuba. And this is what the Haitian people want. The Haitian people want integration with their peers, south-to-south development, not development based on the underdevelopment of Haiti. That's how they frame it, the development of underdevelopment. Haiti has incredible potential. It always has. It's been always punished because of its great resources under the subsoil, and of course its number one resource, the Haitian people. So the Haitian people are looking for a way forward based on the unity of oppressed people and the integration that Nicaragua, Cuba, Venezuela, and now Bolivia and Peru have spearheaded.
Mm-hmm. Danny, there also writes groups criticizing the Biden administration. They say that the returns are inhumane, and that's because of the dire security and economic situation in countries like Haiti. Let's have your take on that.
Of course, they're 100% correct. And to hear Alejandro Mayorkas talk about how humane their treatment of Haitians was is ridiculous. It's an entire system predicated on treating other human beings as subhuman. But I think we have to go even deeper than these liberal critiques. And as I was saying, even if the U.S. were to Biden were to increase the number, the cap to 200,000 new migrants allowed in. Really, there's 10.5 million Haitians, and if you were to open up the border tomorrow because of these institutional, structural, historical, geopolitical issues, what Haitians would stay home in their homeland? And that same question goes for Dominicans and Mexicans and Salvadorians. When you're talking about so many years of inequality, of exploitation, of the devaluation of a people's currency, of occupation, of sanctions, of invasion, what choice do a people have but to flee in pursuit of the stolen resources, the stolen gold, the stolen coffee, the stolen emeralds? So I think this shift in Latin America that's going to play out as we speak at the General Assembly about 100 blocks from me right now, it's going to be very important to see what happens in the next few days. I mean, Latin America and the Caribbean are again on the rise.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we have Keithan Mansfield back on the phone for us. Keithan, go ahead with your comments. Sorry for that interruption.
Yes, well, that's very true. As I was at the United Nations building earlier today, only an hour ago, you see many different groups coming together in support of fighting back against U.S. imperialism, fighting for the sovereignty of their homeland, for the rights of their own people, against those in power in the U.S. And so Biden is not living up to what he promised to be on the campaign trail, which seems to be a popular tradition for American politicians to make promises that not only do they not follow through with, but in Biden's case, done the exact opposite, ramping up deportations, ramping up police funding, ramping up foreign intervention. It's more than anything, it's scary to see that this is the state of the U.S. political climate and the politicians that are put in place to try to represent or pretend to represent the American people. It's a shame. It's a sham.
Keaton rights groups argue that Title 42 is not based on science and is actually a violation of U.S.'s own immigration laws, and they're asking the president to reverse that policy. Now, would President Biden take heed of that and reverse the policy?
I find it unlikely. The U.S. constantly violates its own procedures, protocols. It violates U.N. procedures and international protocols. So the idea that Biden would, unless he's faced with perhaps severe retribution or severe criticism from his own internal party bureaucracy, from Democrats who are in power already, who have sold out to the system, sold out to imperialist practices, it would be very unlikely that Biden would do a 180, so to speak, and suddenly become the president that he pretended he was on the campaign trail.
Okay. Now, Danny, we had White House spokesman just recently announcing that the U.S. government has a range of program options and financial support in place that would assist Haitian nationals and authorities without specifying any further. What could those plans be?
Well, at the most, there'll be drops in the ocean, drops in the bucket. These are liberal band-aids that won't change anything fundamentally in Haiti. It's the core group. It's the Organization of American States and the UN acting under the auspices of the U.S. Embassy that have the final say in all things Haitian. This is an issue about Haitian self-determination. Colonialism and the neocolonialism has always been a one-armed bandit extracting from Haiti. So for Jen Psaki or any representative of the Biden government or any U.S. government to try to project this benevolence towards Haiti is extremely hypocritical. The true benevolence would come in the form of reparations to the tune of billions and billions of dollars restored to the Haitian people for the historical wrongs that have been visited upon them by successive U.S. administrations, both Democrat and Republican.
Mm-hmm. Now, Keaton, we also have the UN Human Rights Office expressing disappointment that there have apparently not been any individual assessments of the cases of the migrants by the United States. Why shouldn't that happen?
Well, the U.S. has been guilty of human rights violations since the American War for Independence in 1776, be it persecution and military removal and extinction of Native American tribes here in the U.S., or during World War II, the imprisonment of Japanese Americans, or of course, Jim Crow era and slavery. The U.S. has a long-standing history. The United States government has a long-standing history of human rights abuses. And then the U.S. will take this, however, and then make international claims that no, China is the enemy. China is abusing human rights. Iran is abusing human rights. Cuba, Venezuela, Haiti. The list goes on and on. At this point, it seems that human rights, or the concept of human rights, has simply become a political bargaining tool for those in power, for the most powerful in the UN, Britain and the United States. So to toy with this idea that the U.S. will rightfully and thoroughly address human rights allegations, to me seems like nonsense. It would be very out of character for the U.S. state apparatus.
Mm-hmm. Danny, let's look at it from a different angle. Isn't it thanks to Washington's own policies and meddling in some countries' affairs that forces some people to leave their countries and look for better lives elsewhere, like in the U.S.? I mean, isn't it the case of chickens coming home to roost?
That's exactly correct, and not just some people, but millions and millions, if not billions. How many Libyans, how many Syrians, how many Afghans have died making the perilous trek across the Mediterranean, across Asia, in Europe, trying to find a better way? So people are going to follow capital. people historically are going to follow the very resources usurped from them, it really comes at no surprise. And this is going to continue to happen. The right-wing media blitz right now, they continue to call this Biden's border crisis, as though Biden somehow created all of this. This goes way deeper than any individual politician. This goes hemisphere and centuries deep. So it begs a much more critical perspective on U.S. foreign policy. And until there's a fundamental change in the relationship between U.S. hegemony and U.S. unipolarity in the world's people, nothing will change. And how hypocritical Biden was at the U.N. just a few hours ago talking about there's no new Cold War, will work with anybody. But look at the unfettered aggression against China, against Russia, against Vietnam, against Pyongyang, against any country who dares to defy U.S. unipolarity.
Mm-hmm. Keaton, let's have your opinion on the same question.
Well, I was always introduced to this topic through the analogy that when someone pulls a gun, when someone has a firearm, the safest place to be is behind the person holding the gun, and I think that translates pretty well into immigration into the United States. When U.S. and NATO toppled Gaddafi's Libya, thousands and thousands of Libyans flee to the United States, flee to France, flee to the West, because, quite frankly, the U.S. is the only country that the U.S. cannot orchestrate a regime change in. And so it's trying to, people are trying to go to the safest place, which ultimately ends up being going to the aggressor, going to the oppressor historically and currently. And so the U.S.'s attempt to, as Danny said, that constantly pushing this aggression against China, who's attempting to build infrastructure and build hospitals and schools and put capital, put money to good use, the U.S. doesn't want that. And so any sort of pro-China, or more specifically, any sort of anti-American government is going to be an enemy of the U.S. State Department, of the intelligence agencies, and in turn, has got to go. It's got to be destroyed. It doesn't matter the cost of human lives. Iraq, Saddam had to go, no matter the cost. And so it's a historical thing. It's not even a phenomenon at this point. It is just a consistent foreign policy of the U.S. to take out anybody they don't like, no matter what the cost is.
Right. Daniel, I got one last question for you, and I want Keaton also to comment on that. And that's, if you can think of any solution to this migrant problem in the United States?
Well, we can definitely think of a solution. That solution is called socialism. That solution is called reparations. That solution is called fight back, the unity of all oppressed people. Until there's a people's government here from D.C. to Miami to Los Angeles, nothing's going to change. This system, capitalism, is based on the pillaging of people's resources across the world. That's why they've gone after Syria so savagely. Look at these cruel sanctions imposed upon Tehran and upon Caracas and Havana, and now you have further aggression against Nicaragua. And I think it's time for the American people to connect the dots that who is the aggression meted out against. Any system that does not conform with U.S. hegemony, immediately they are under the boot and under the gun of U.S. militarism.
Okay, Keaton, what's the solution to the immigrant problem?
I absolutely think there is a solution. And I'm a political analyst for the Center for Political Innovation. And we have proposed the policy solution, which is the San Dino-Zapata Economic Corridor. The United States, China, and Russia should partner together. They should invest the money that currently goes into arms manufacturing and maintaining nuclear weapons, take that money and invest it into a sort of Central and South American Belt and Road Initiative. Build infrastructure, build factories, build schools, and build hospitals in cooperation with the government of Central America. And then after these things are built, turn them over, turn the management and the ownership of these roads and schools and public facilities completely over to the government of that country. Make it viable for people to stay in their homeland. Make it economically viable for people in Central and South America to remain in their homeland, remain where their families have been for generations, and live a good, a very, very good and robust life without having to be concerned about where is food coming from. Is, you know, is the U.S. going to kill our president tomorrow? That's the solution.
Okay. Okay, on that note, we'll come to the end of this edition of The Spotlight. Let me thank our guests. We have Professor at the City University of New York, Danish Shah, in New York, and author and political analyst for the Center for Political Innovation, Keaton Mansfield, also in New York. And I've been your host, Behrouz Najaf, and I'll see you next time.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In Nigeria, the revered Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki, following his recent release after an illegally prolonged detention of over 5 years, is again active on the social scene. He has restarted his lectures that over the past decades have changed the face of the northern parts of Africa's most populous country by guiding at least 14 million people to the enlightened path of the Ahlul Bayt, or the blessed household of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kayhan International staff. This article is published under the heading, Sheikh Zakzaki's Spirit of Resistance Back on Nigerian Social Scene. Stay tuned for more. Freedom, its flag bearers, and the resolve to cater to the needs of the society can never be suppressed in any part of the world, despite the most inhuman measures used against them by the traffickers of terrorism. This is the lesson humanity has learned from the epic sacrifice of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, whose martyrdom has continued to inspire the seekers of freedom and justice in every era and in every place. In our own times, there are many vivid examples of how Karbala has infused the spirit of freedom and resistance and the quest for justice in contemporary communities, the prime example being the Islamic Republic of Iran, which for the past 42 years has continued to defeat whatever satanic plots the United States and its agents have come up with. The message from Iran today is evident all around, from Afghanistan to the Levant, and to Latin America and West Africa, where American-sponsored terrorism has failed. In Nigeria, the revered Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki, following his recent release after an illegally prolonged detention of over 5 years, is again active on the social scene. He has restarted his lectures that over the past decades have changed the face of the northern parts of Africa's most populous country by guiding at least 14 million people to the enlightened path of the Ahlul Bayt, or the blessed household of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. This had horrified the regime of Muhammadu Buhari, a former general with a bloody record of military coup and seizure of power in 1980s, and who now, despite being an elected president, does not hesitate in taking orders from the world's most notorious terrorist regimes, such as the Zionists and the Wahhabis, to suppress freedom and justice in Nigeria. Sheikh Zakzaki, his most prominent victim, whose sons were killed by the Nigerian military during its terrorist attack on the town of Zaria, and the massacre of over 1,000 men, women, and children on 15th December 2015 during a peaceful religious gathering, is possessed with an indomitable spirit that never broke down during the 5.5 years of torturous imprisonment he and his wife went through, even deprived of medical treatment for their ailments. Last Sunday on September 19th, in Abuja, several families of martyrs of the military's December 2015 massacre met with the leader of the Islamic movement, IMN, who consoled them for the losses of their loved ones and urged them to always remember the persecution and hardships suffered by Imam Hussein, peace upon him, at the hands of the army of the Umayyad tyrant Yazid that besieged and massacred them in Karbala in 61 AH. He told the bereaved families that no sacrifice is too high when it comes to the path of Allah, adding, "We are proud of carrying bullet fragments in our bodies, and this is proof of our spirit of resistance and refusal to yield to tyranny." Among the visitors was Dr. Isa Waziri Guantu, who said he lost 4 of his children during the Zaria massacre, but is determined to follow the right path championed by Sheikh Zakzaki. Another visitor was Hajia Jumeh Karofi, who lost 5 children. The proud mother said, "I would like the killers of my children to know that what they did to them would never scare us away from Sheikh Zakzaki and the Islamic movement in Nigeria. In fact, they are ready to pay the ultimate sacrifice in defense of Islam." It is still not too late for President Buhari to atone for his atrocities against the Nigerian Muslims by apologizing to Sheikh Zakzaki and the bereaved families whose members his army had brutally massacred. Islam is a religion of repentance and forgiveness, and the sooner he does, the better for him, in order to weed out repression and injustice from Nigeria. No matter what the Israelis, the Saudis, the Americans, and all other traffickers of terrorism think.
morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.